National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The Supreme Court heard a case this week that's been called by some activists the most important transgender rights case to go before the high court. Legal analyst Andrea Pachotti Bayer joins us with analysis of this case involving minors and sex-altering medical interventions. Then we turn to more spiritual matters this Advent. As we prepare ourselves for Christmas, Register staff writer Matthew McDonald shares how meatless Fridays may help deepen our appetite for the feast of God's love poured out in Christ's birth. I'm Jeanette DeMello, host of Register Radio, together with Matthew Bunsen, my co-host and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. Matthew, before we turn to Andrea on this important case, I want to point out that this is an eventful weekend in the life of the Church. Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris will reopen. And also at the Vatican, Pope Francis will be installing 21 new cardinals. Can you share with us some highlights of the consistory?
Yeah, first, it's great to be with you and a blessed Advent to everyone. You're absolutely right. This is the 10th consistory on the part of Pope Francis, cementing his legacy and his imprint on the college. In some ways, this is a microcosm of all of the consistories that have gone before it and his vision for the College of Cardinals. The likelihood is that one of these members of the College of Cardinals, not necessarily of this group, but one of the members of the college will succeed him as Pope. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to keep track of who's joining, but in particular from where. And Pope Francis, in that sense, has picked once again from the peripheries, the periferia, as he calls it, from cardinals and archbishops from tiny populations of Catholics. I think, for example, of Archbishop Jean-Paul Vesco, who's the Metropolitan Archbishop of Algeria, or Archbishop Dominique Mathieu, who's a Franciscan from the Archdiocese of Tehran-Isfahan, which, as you can imagine, doesn't have a huge population. But Francis has always been very keen on bringing in those voices from the far-flung corners of the Church. And then there have been a few surprises. One was the Dominican theologian and preacher, Father Timothy Radcliffe, who is probably known for two things, one being the spiritual guide in many ways for the last synod and the synod on synodality, but also for some of the controversial things that he said about human sexuality. And so he's given this honor. He's only months away from turning 80, so he likely will not participate. But this is a statement in some ways from Pope Francis. Then we have one of the youngest, or what would be the now youngest member of the college, and that's a Bishop Beehawk from Australia, of all places, who's the Bishop of Saints Peter and Paul of Melbourne, of the Ukrainian Eastern Church. And then and probably everyone's favorite for this consistory is Archbishop Angelo Acerbi, who is a longtime Vatican diplomat. It is notable because he is 99 years old at the time of his appointment.
I knew you had to mention him.
I had to mention Acerbi. 99 years old, the oldest cardinal to be appointed. So he is certainly also the oldest of the cardinals. So it's a very interesting group, but also very much in keeping with Pope Francis's style.
Yes, it's fascinating what this means for his legacy, but that's probably a whole nother discussion. And we have an important one to have today about news at home. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that challenges a Tennessee law prohibiting medical interventions that aim to transition a child from his or her biological sex to the opposite sex. And Andrea Pachotti Bayer has been covering this for the Register. She is the director of the Conscience Project and a legal analyst for EWTN News and, of course, a columnist at the Register. Andrea, it's great to have you on Register Radio again.
I always love joining you guys. It's always so much fun.
So this case was heard on Wednesday, oral arguments, and the oral argument in the case is U.S. versus Scarmetti. So that's the title of the case. But it's there are several parties involved in this one, and it's quite an interesting conflict. As I mentioned in the intro, Andrea, it's considered a rather important case because of its implications on other potential transgender-type laws. So let's talk about who are the parties involved in this, and what is the conflict that is before our high court?
Yeah, Jeanette, thanks for asking about this. I consider this one of the most consequential cases under review by the court this term. It does deal with Tennessee's ban on these kinds of medical treatments for minors. What's interesting, Scrimeti is the Tennessee Attorney General, and I think he's really the hero in this. And the on the other side of the case is the Biden administration and the ACLU representing some minors who are struggling with gender dysphoria, their parents, and a medical professional who engages in treating these children with medical interventions to change the appearance of their sex to something that's different from their biological sex. They've challenged the case, interestingly enough, claiming that it's a 14th Amendment violation. Folks will remember that the 14th Amendment secures equal protection under the law. And they're trying to kind of put shoehorn the idea that this is this ban is discriminatory on the basis of sex. So they're not arguing, the Biden administration nor the ACLU are arguing that transgender status per se is a protected class, but they're saying that sex discrimination requires heightened scrutiny by judges when they're looking at laws that discriminate on the basis of sex. Now, the Tennessee Solicitor General was very clear in saying this isn't about discrimination. This is about banning a procedure that the lawmakers, after study, have seen can cause serious and lasting injuries to young people, and asking that we just allow young people to have a chance to work through all of this. And then if when they're adults, they still want to pursue these kinds of interventions, they can. I think that's a reasonable role that the state of Tennessee is taking, mm-hmm. and they're not alone. 26 states do have limitations on interventions. 24 include hormonal therapies, puberty blockers, and two additional ones involve surgeries. And so I think that this is really illustrative of the response that lawmakers of sound mind are taking to protect and safeguard children from the social contagion of gender ideology.
Yeah, Andrea, this has obviously attracted huge attention given where we are culturally in the country and that the heavy focus on the whole transgender ideology movement. But the implications of this case seem to go well beyond even just Tennessee. I mean, it seems to be dragging in as well issues of participation in sports and even bathroom spaces. So could you talk about what are those implications and how could it affect all these other states?
Yeah, I mean, first off, the states that have similar laws to Tennessee's are very much directly affected by how the court will decide this case. In listening to the over 2-hour oral argument, many of the justices, specifically Justice Brett Kavanaugh, was really concerned about if they were to rule in favor of striking down the Tennessee law, what would that mean for any other limitations on kind of the trans insanity, as I like to call it. And I think my sense is that the court isn't willing to go as far as the ACLU and the Biden administration are asking, which in my mind is weaponizing the Constitution to kind of give legal cover for gender ideology and instead is more looking to the reasonable exercise of the state's authority to regulate health and safety in their jurisdiction.
Andrea, you know, questions, you wrote about this at the Register. You wrote two articles this week, commentaries, one before the oral arguments and one after, that those both can be found at ncregister.com. But you really examine some of the questions over health ramifications of sex change surgeries and other medical interventions on children that were raised by the justices during the argument. What points did they raise, particularly about the science that the U.S. government and others were putting forward about these cases?
Well, and Jeanette, I think that we've seen a lot of debunking. Just, you know, a year and a half ago, people were claiming that these interventions were necessary in order to address suicidality, and depression, anxiety in children that are struggling with gender dysphoria. And since then, it's come to light that many reviews, systemic reviews, are showing that that's just not true. And really pushing against this narrative that this is really the best solution or the only solution for helping children with gender dysphoria. What was really disappointing in my mind is that the Biden administration, the Solicitor General, during argument, as well as the ACLU, continue to kind of double down on this false and now debunked findings. And to their credit, many of the justices, again, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Samuel Alito, who your listeners will know was the author of the important Dobbs decision striking down Roe versus Wade, they raised the issue. And in particular, said, you know, European countries are walking this back. Why are we pushing forward? And what was their answer? And basically, the answer wasn't at all satisfying from the ACLU or from the Solicitor General's office.
Yeah, so I guess based on listening to the oral arguments, based on the temperament of the various judges, do you have a sense for where this is likely to go and when that'll happen?
Yeah, Matthew, you know, I'm always worried about predicting. You never can predict things until the decision comes
yes,
out, then you
exactly.
know what the Supreme Court. But I think that the court was very concerned about courts and judges playing medical professionals. And instead leaving these issues to lawmakers to assess the evidence before them at the time and make decisions that they feel were within their authority, again, to regulate health and safety. I would think it would be a good wager to say that the justices really just don't see the 14th Amendment, or at least the originalist justices, as being willing to kind of take sex discrimination as far as these advocates want it to basically shoehorn transgenderism into our concept of sex discrimination under the Constitution, even though some of those justices were responsible for seeing that in the context of statutory interpretation, dealing with Title VII, our federal law prohibiting discrimination in employment. I think the justices just aren't willing to treat the Constitution with that same kind of analysis.
Andrea, it's always a pleasure having you analyze these important cases, especially when they have such broad implications. So thank you so much for joining us on Register Radio, and our listeners can find Andrea's work at ncregister.com. We'll be taking a short break, and then when we come back, you'll hear from Matthew McDonald, who's written a story about Meatless Fridays and how this might be an appropriate way to deepen our Advent devotion. Stay tuned to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, host of Register Radio, together with Matthew Bunsen, my co-host. We're in the Advent season, and the Register has published online content as well as content in print that can help us prepare our hearts to better celebrate Christ's birth. Alisa Murphy, the Register's digital content editor, joins us with some highlights. Alisa, it's so good to have you. What are some of the pieces that people shouldn't miss this season?
You know, one that did extremely well online, you'll see it in the next our print edition coming up, is Father Jeffrey Kirby's take on the three Advents.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes about the three Advents as being the three comings or arrivals of Jesus. And this really has to do with the fact that while we wait in joyful hope for the Lord to come at Christmas, we also remember the second coming. As Father Kirby says, and I quote, "As seen in the Catechism, the Church actually makes a direct comparison between the anticipation of the Lord's first coming as a means of hope as we await his second coming." And so Advent includes these two Advents. And then, of course, in this year of Eucharistic revival, he speaks about the third Advent,
right,
which really points to the Eucharistic sacrifice, the fact that Jesus is made present to us every day in the sacrifice of the Mass. And Jeanette, he quotes this beautiful homily by Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, who so succinctly put it this way: The first coming was in flesh and weakness. The middle coming is in spirit and power. And the final coming will be in glory and majesty. It's yeah, a really beautiful piece.
I did find it really beautiful too, especially the Eucharistic Advent. That really touched me. During this year, we've been focusing so much on the Eucharist and that part. That commentary just really hit home for me. And as you mentioned, that's in the December 15th print edition, so that's coming up. But it can also be found online as so much of the content. So what are some of the other pieces that you would have us look to?
So we also had the great opportunity to speak with Father Mike Schmitz, who had a different take on Advent this year. He says it's not really about living, quote unquote, slightly more spiritual during these 4 weeks. It's really about understanding our own mortality and how we need Jesus. He literally is asking people to contemplate their death this Advent. And he points to three things that we should be actively doing, including confession, so we can truly be ready while we are waiting and clinging to prayer. And then also caring for the people around us. And he points to the fact that we are called to care for others, and we will indeed be judged this way. I also did ask Father Mike Schmitz about the secular forces at play right now, everything about, you know, we hear about tinsel and twinkling lights, Santa and Elf on the Shelf. How do we go about marrying these, especially within families? And he said, why not leverage the good? Everyone wants to be together and share in this time to gather with friends and family. So it's okay to watch Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer with your family. Just make sure you always remind them that Jesus is indeed the reason for the season. And he also tells a very cool story about a family tradition he had as a kid baking birthday cakes for Jesus. So it's a really fun read.
That's awesome. Elisa, I'm always grateful when you give us these highlights about what's going on the Register pages. So thanks so much for joining us today with those. And we've got another one to talk with Matt McDonald about. And that was a piece that really did well online. People were very interested in this story about meatless Fridays. So no meat on Fridays. Matt, this is an interesting time for a story like this. We're talking about Advent, not Lent. So, Matthew McDonald, it's great to have you. Why are we talking about Meatless Fridays now?
Advent used to be a time of penance. It is, to some extent now, it's by invitation now, but it used to be a time where the church required a large amount of penance, actually. Fasting, an abstinence on Wednesdays and Fridays throughout Advent, for instance, and other practices.
This is absolutely right, because it's a season of penitence, right? And penance. So you actually just wrote about that as well. So you've got two stories right now running at the Register, one on Meatless Fridays, another one on Advent is all about penance, which I loved reading, because it's true. I mean, we jump right to the celebration of Christmas, it feels like, especially with all the decorations and just jump right into festivity. But it, as your article says, 'tis the season of penance. Advent isn't Advent without it. And so both of these stories are a little different take on how to prepare ourselves for Christmas. Yet your story on the fasting came from the U.S. Bishops' meeting. This was proposed during that meeting by one of the bishops, and you took that and ran with it. So what did you find when you started to probe our bishops about Meatless Fridays?
This suggestion hit a nerve with people. And by that, I don't mean that they're all supporting it or they're all ready to jump on the bandwagon. But I got a lot of responses and a fair number of positive responses, bishops who were at least open to the idea. To give a little background, before 1966, as Catholics of a certain age will know, every Friday of the year, almost, was considered a day we're not supposed to eat meat. And since 1966, in the United States, that's only the case on Ash Wednesday, on Fridays during Lent, and on Good Friday, which technically is not title Lent. And so that was a major change 58 years ago. And an Eastern Rite bishop in November during the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops fall meeting suggested that the church go back to no meat on Fridays in some fashion.
Yeah, Matt, Archbishop Gudziak, in his presentation to the bishops about this very topic, cited that there are environmental benefits to doing this. And we are, of course, in the age of Pope Francis and the time of Laudato Si. What was your take on that? And what was he getting at in terms of that?
He didn't say directly. There's a theory that raising animals for food takes more natural resources than raising other types of food, and that that process has a bad effect on the environment. I assume that's what he was referring to.
Well, I was going to say, though, that this isn't something that's entirely new, is it? I mean, there have been some pushes in recent years toward reestablishing some sort of a fast. Where have those been taking place?
One bishop told me that he remembered a bishop making this suggestion years ago. He thought more than 10 years ago at one of the bishops' meetings, either in the spring or in the fall. But it didn't get a lot of attention because he couldn't remember even when it was or who the bishop was who made it. But there is this sense among some of the bishops that there's a need for more opportunities for penance. I'll give you an example. Boston Archbishop Richard Henning, who's the new Archbishop of Boston, suggested to me that he's noticed a hungering for penance, particularly among young people. And he said he didn't endorse this proposal, but he was intrigued by it and wants to hear more about it. That was the kind of response I got from a lot of bishops. One bishop, the Archbishop of Seattle, Archbishop Paul Etienne, said that the bishops need to lay the groundwork to explain to people what penance is, why self-denial for a spiritual purpose is useful, and how that might be connected to denying oneself food for a period of time or abstaining from a particular type of food.
That's right. And, you know, some have suggested that if the bishops were to bring back this penance on Fridays, this abstaining from meat, that it might not be the type of thing completely equivalent to what it was in the past, which if you broke that fast, it was a mortal sin. So some are suggesting to bring this back, but maybe not have it bear that same weight. That's going to be a tricky thing. And I do hope that the bishops do take this up. I think the proposal was that maybe they could discuss it next June during their next meeting, June 2025, to discuss how they might incorporate this kind of fast again into the life of the church. And I think it's very interesting that the church would do something like that at this moment, that we would talk about that. The Register, as you know, Matt, ran your story in the print edition. That's the December 1st print edition, and also had an editorial on the same topic, which is suggesting, is really calling for a return to meatless Fridays. And I do see the benefit of this, and many of the people you talked to did, in that it's a universal fast, right? It's not just us choosing our own penance on Friday, which is what the church hoped we would do when they lifted the Friday fast from meat. But what do you see the value in such a universal fast? I don't know if any of the bishops or others spoke to you about that, or even just your insights into a universal fast.
They did, and there are a couple aspects about it. First is there's a strong sense that although the bishops in 1966 wanted people to either abstain from meat on Fridays on their own or substitute some other act of penance or charity, that's not what happened. Catholics heard, oh, this rule doesn't exist anymore, mm-hmm. and they just stopped following it and didn't substitute anything in. So there's a sense that something was lost when that happened. And then second, there's a sense that this was part of the identity of being a Catholic. Everybody understood, whether the person was a Catholic or not, that Catholics didn't eat meat on Fridays, and it was an identifier. It was building a team spirit, if you will. It was something that set Catholics apart and made Catholics conscious of their faith in a way that isn't the case now. Now, when it's just Fridays during Lent, it's not a large portion of the year. A lot of people forget about it or don't observe it. And there's a sense that something was lost along those lines as well. And a number, several bishops made a similar point to me along those lines.
Yeah, that's right. And I loved a point that was made by one of your lay, I'm missing her name right now, but one of your lay...
Maria Morrow. Morrow.
Maria Morrow said that she hoped that people wouldn't just turn to some other kind of gourmet meal with, like, you know, expensive seafood or something like that in such a fast, but would actually make it you know, a true fast, not just a substitute for meat and another really great meal. And I thought that point was really poignant, especially in a place like Louisiana, where I'm from. We can very easily give up meat, but, you know, maybe turning to a soup or a sandwich is a better fast, and that's a more appropriate fast. So, Matt, I love both pieces. I think these are great reminders of this time, this season of Advent. And I'm going to name those articles again. 'Tis the season of penance. Advent isn't Advent without it. And No Meat Fridays. Both of these are by Matthew McDonald and can be found at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks, Jeanette. And thanks, Matthew.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. Until next week, on behalf of my producer, Michael McCall, my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, and myself, Jeanette DeMello, I pray that until next week, God bless you.